She gonna mess your mind. American woman gonna mess your mind. American woman gonna mess your mind. Say A, say M, say E, say R, say I, C, say A, M. American woman gonna mess your mind. American woman gonna mess your mind. American woman gonna mess your mind.
Get away from me, America. Welcome to the roundtable for May 8th, 2024. Let me add the crew here. Gents, thanks for jumping on. We've got about an hour and a half. Try and keep this in the time zone so it's not a two-hour marathon. What's going on with my camera? That's interesting. Hey, there we go. Hey. So lots to talk about tonight. I want to talk about, so Clay and I did an interview earlier today. Matt, you and I still have to do one. So I expect you to block out all your time and make it appropriate and easy for me because it needs to be convenient for me, just so you know. Colonel. But we did an interview today. We talked about, what'd you call it, barbarian camps? Is that what you call it, Clay?
Yeah, barbarian camp model.
Yeah, so I'm just going to let you explain it because I talked too much, according to the audience earlier, so I'm going to talk less now. So
okay. Sorry, barbarian village model. So the barbarian village model is basically saying that the actual way to survive what comes next is uncomfortable. We're going to have to actually get our people to move into, like, well, compounds, for lack of a better word. So you actually have enough family units to protect all of your stuff, like your goats and chickens and things like that. Just it's a hellfire target, but if we're worried about hellfires, well, we've got bigger problems. The bigger thing is, as crime gets worse and cartel size violence gets worse, you're really going to need like 10 to 20 dudes to be able to handle run-of-the-mill problems
and build a fortified position. Yeah, I agree. So we'll start there because there's a lot to that. I want to go around the room and see, you know, if everybody A, agrees that that's where we're headed, and then B, any other considerations around that. And Troop, I know you have a lot of thoughts on this one. So
yeah, I have a video uploading. A lot of people are asking about bayonets and stuff like that, and I said, well, the first rule of bayonet fighting is to avoid it. But I did a little video, but I started out the video with the four different mindsets that I view the world with. And so the first one is our military mindset. And that's, you know, we're in a team formation. We have resources replenishment. We have targets, objectives. There are usually two hostile people that are pressing against each other. And you have an authorization to project violence. And the second mindset is law enforcement mindset, where you always have the upper hand. You have the monopoly on violence. If you need to call for help, other guys with guns are going to show up that are also allowed to use violence. And when you're in that scenario, you are the grown up in the room. You're the one that's projecting that authority. And the expectation is that people are going to respect that authority. The third mindset is the civilian mindset that most people are in. And that's kind of the docile mindset of, I need to obey the law. I'm not allowed to preemptively utilize violence unless there's a very apparent, reasonable likelihood that not intervening is going to not prevent something from happening. But generally, you can't justify the use of violence unless there's violence being projected upon you or someone else. But the fourth mindset is what I think Clay is talking about, and that's the predator mindset. The predator knows that they can't go up against the military, they can't go up against a law enforcement officer, and they don't participate in society very well. So they're going to strike when it's convenient for them. They're going to wait behind a bush for a jogger to run by. They're going to wait in an alley for somebody to walk by before they club them over the head and steal their wallet. They're going to shoot the store clerk. They're going to abduct the child. And so part of the video that I did with the knife fighting is, you have to go all in on that because you're probably going to get cut. You're very likely going to die, because if you fix bayonet, that means that you ran out of ammo and the enemy didn't. So your whole job is just to stick as many of them as you can before they run out of ammo and you run out of guys, right? So with the barbarian village thing, you're kind of all in there as well, but you're all in and both of the ethoses of psychology, because you have an external threat, but then you have an internal kind of community. And anytime you have an internal community, there's competition, there's resource sharing, there's different ideologies. You have to appoint leaders, and sometimes they're in conflict. So then you have to learn how to delegate to avoid conflict. Like, you're in charge of farm, you're in charge of cow milk, you're in charge of chickens, you're in charge of perimeter security. So you have to figure out how to work with people within that team. But you have to think like a predator, because when you're confronted with a predator, the mindset of a civilian is that you should do no harm, that it's bad to hurt people, right? Which generally it is, unless they're trying to hurt you. So you have to get through that mental block in order to be successful. When it comes down to the fact that you're probably going to end up with permanently debilitating injuries and scars on your body, you want to limit the amount of those that are inflicted upon you and kill your enemy as fast as possible. So you want to have at least a few of the, you know, a few of the ants in your ant colony or your barbarian village. They need to be like the soldier ants, but then you can't forget that you need all the worker ants as well. And they need to kind of collaborate. So I'm 100% on board with Clay, and that we really could unpack that.
Matt.
I mean, we're already doing that. It's all those things. I mean, it's sociology 101, man. We're literally already doing those things, and to take it to a higher echelon, so to speak, you're seeing this, we'll say the 10,000 foot level, the macro level. What we're seeing among late millennials and Gen Z is the realization of a couple of things. First, they're never going to retire. Okay, this whole retirement scam, they know it. Okay, they know it. The second reality is that they are banding together in order to buy land, because land itself for most people out there is prohibitively expensive. And here's the other thing. I'm about to beat up on California.
Please do.
I know there's a lot of good Californians out there, okay, but y'all are not sending your best to everywhere else. And what you're doing though, where I'm going with this, is those people are coming in from the tech coast and they're buying up land and driving the price of everything through the roof, along with reevaluations of tax values on properties, pricing people out. And it's always the same places. It's always San Francisco, Los Angeles, Portland, and shithole Seattle, right? It's those. So because of that, in a lot of rural areas like the one that I live in, and I talk to people in a lot of other places where I teach classes, Missouri, Texas, but I mean, Montana is another perfect example of that. You know, we were just out there. That part of Montana is getting, basically, it's getting overrun by wealthy Californians. So here's the thing, is that the Gen Z kids and late millennials are banding together, and they're starting to pool money together in a collective bargaining style of, hey, you know, we're going to do this and you're going to do that, kind of a revisitation of the old co-op model. And that's exactly what's happening. You know, we tend to get tied up, because we're all military here. We tend to get tied up with like the kinetic things and, you know, the actions on kind of shit, because that's what we've done. But, you know, it was so much like I literally spent all day today patching barbed wire fences where I've got cows trying to get out. Like, you're going to be doing so much more of that kind of thing, and get used to it. But they're seeing it, they're realizing it, and you know, that's kind of where we're, the direction we're moving in.
That's actually very heartening, because yeah, I think that's the only way. I mean, I really believe that. I think this, I don't know what kind of time frame, but I think that we'll be to that Mad Max world point where that's the only way to you know, live for the next 20 years behind walls.
Yeah, we talked about that earlier, and I noodled on that after you and I talked today. And, you know, I think we all agree that this only ends one way now. It ends with some kind of gunfire in some format over an extended period of time. And it'll take decades, if not, you know, a good 50 years to unwind some of the things that have been done, to unwind some of the situations that we have in front of us, but more importantly, to rebuild the knowledge base here and the industrial base here. That's going to take a significant amount of time to do. And in the meantime, we're going to have a bulk of the population figure out a way to survive in the meantime. Because look, and I said this earlier, at some point they're going to lose control, right? Any complex operation, when you've got multiple lines of operation and the enemy has to do exactly what you want them to do in order for your lines of operation to coalesce, that never happens. And it's, you know, it's going to turn to shit at some point. And when it does, this is going to go tribal and we're going to have to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, figure out how to survive and mount a defense all at the same fucking time. So, you know, and I wanted to put it in stark reality, because for this crew, all of us have been in that situation where it was all on the line and we know exactly what that looks like. But there's a whole portion of the population that has no concept of what this looks like, just like they have no concept. And I think the guy who says it the best is Bracken. I hate to say it, but he was right, right? This is going to go cannibal in 3 days, and the absolute worst barbarians in the world are already here, and we're going to have to fight them off. And he's right. The more I see it, the more I see what's coming across the border, the more I believe in that aspect of this. So the other part of this that I wanted to get to from this conversation was, what's a good call to action for people right now, right? Because there's three things that have to be, at least, and correct me if I'm wrong, right? There's three or four lines of operation need to be going on right now. There should be some kind of organization at the local level. There should be some kind of mentorship of the younger generations. Then there should be some kind of, for lack of a better word, alternate economy set up already, or at least in the process of being set up already. And then alternative comms, right? Because they're going to take down social media. It's just a matter of when they're going to take it down. Fucking Rumble's gone. You know, Twitter's going to be up because that's state owned, but everything else will be down. True Social will be down. Rumble will be down. Cloud Hub, all these other platforms, and they're going to be down. So alternative comms are going to be very, very important moving forward. So I'll just leave it there and let you guys chew on that one.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is me talking a lot of shit for a guy that's on a digital platform right now and you know, has a, you know, Twitter feed or whatever. But I've said this for years. I think this is the biggest part, is getting people to understand that it has to be local. Like, wherever you are now, unless you're coming into some money and you're going to, you know, buy the fucking magic compound and, you know, I don't know, with a Ranger battalion to protect it, which is going to be very expensive. You know what I mean? Like, What you fucking got is what you got. We are, I believe, close to the dollar just being absolutely fucking useless. So you have got to organize at the local level. That is the most important thing. Find some friends. Hey, man, where you? They might not be, you know, Delta Force Steve. Like, find some friends. I don't care who they are. They can do some shit, patch the barbed wire, whatever. You got to have those people, and that has to be the primary focus right now.
So, just making sure, I didn't want to step on anybody. There's an example of this. So I was, doing coffee and a mic yesterday, and before we went on air, we were having a, conversation that kind of carried over into the show. And then I elaborated further on it once we were off, 'cause, we just didn't drift in that direction, but I was talking about parallel economies. There's a lot of lessons that can be learned from the Latin community, especially like here in North Carolina and across the Southeast, but really it's everywhere now. But they've done all of that. Like most of it. So like, let's think about this. Most of them are here illegally already, right? So that's the first hurdle of, you know, when people are like, oh, I can't do that, it's against the law. And it's like, now I don't want to advocate anybody break any laws or anything like that. Like, but seriously, it's like little things. Okay. Little things that are mental blockades to violating societal norms. Right. So like once you've done one thing, it's an indoctrination process. Right. Sometimes it's called prisonization. Sometimes it's called criminalization, whatever. Here's the deal. Right. They're already illegal here. They're already used to living, you know, kind of below, like almost in the underground sense. If you go to any flea market around here, where I am in this part of North Carolina, one of the largest flea markets literally in the entire world is about 30 miles away from me. And you can look this flea market up on YouTube. There's like a mini video documentary of this place. You can buy anything you want. You can buy cars. You can buy bootleg movies like a Haji shop overseas. You can buy livestock there, hand stitched cowboy boots, everything, like, and everything in between. Quinceañera dress, if you need one of those, they got it. But here's the thing, is that not all of the transactions occur with U.S. dollars. There's a barter economy going on there. There is a precious metals based economy that's going on there. I'm telling you, if you walk in there with silver, especially like American Silver Eagles or Mexican Libertads, you walk in there, like, they recognize those as currency, bro. It's you can get anything. But like, now it's got to the point to where they have their own medical care system that works in the underground. Like, they've got docs, they go to get patched up. Right. They have their own internal trading system. They have their own internal cultural system. And, that's what they've got. It's really interesting seeing all of this, especially having a sociology background and then like really noticing things after growing up in this area. But they're already doing all of that. And so for, anybody that's like, oh, man, I don't know what we could learn from that. You could learn a whole hell of a lot from them, because that's the lifestyle that you're actually striving towards. They're already doing it. Oh, and the last little bit about the whole tactical thing and everything else. So also here in Central North Carolina, we have a lot of street gang activity. You know, we've got the black gangs that are trying to victimize the Latin community. What does that do? That brings in protection rackets. Well, there you go. Society and a subsection of society will only tolerate violence that could potentially blow back on them as long as it is within their bounds of acceptability. You have to be defending something. And in their case, it was because they were being victimized. A lot of Latinos work for cash, right? So they're sitting on big piles of cash. They can't deposit in banks or nothing like that. So they're going to get victimized while they're out doing, labor. They're going to get people trying to break into their house. And that gets taken care of. It's being taken care of, right? That's a constant thing. And it's a source of criminality here in where I live in North Carolina. So anyway, last piece about that is they learn something from that. Like they're doing it. That's the lifestyle you're looking to lead. So there you go.
And yeah, I would say they imported it and brought it from wherever they were at, right? Because you have underground economies in almost every Latin American country, as well as across the Middle East, right? I would say it's outside of the U.S. It's in almost every country on the planet except for Europe, because I can remember being in Vietnam and seeing the alternative economy right in front of me. In fact, one of my translators that was there with me literally was like, don't buy it here. You can get it cheaper at the, at this other market. And it's all black market. It's all stuff that, they don't want to run taxes through. And I think what's interesting is it's here too in Arizona. You can see that the barter economy is alive and well in the Latin community. And, we've been taught that, it's a bunch of shysters. That's really not the case, right? And by the way, I got to say that I miss the Haji movies where, the guy's got the camera and he's laughing with the movie and the camera's moving. I miss those. That was too funny. But that whole economy is going to be very important for most Americans. And again, it's one of those cultural norms and those idioms that we have that literally we can't embrace anything outside of what's accepted or what's been taught to us, right? We're taught to be rule followers. And, the short answer, because Clay was talking about it earlier, is you're going to have to be ruthless, right? So when the wheels come off, full fucking send. There's no partial send. It's full fucking send, right? Somebody shows up, I don't know you, neck tattoos, full send, let it sell in. And you can't even, most people can't even think that way. you can't even have a conversation with people to have that kind of a discussion just in general, because they can't get their head around the brutality that's in front of us, the just the abject violence that comes with a lot of these cultures that have been imported here, especially, God, imagine what's going to happen when Hamas hits the ground, right? They're going to be like frat kids in the middle of their first year in school. They're going to go off the fucking rails. And I can't wait to see how that's going to play out, especially in the big cities. So that conversation just in general is going to be very important. But then also the conversation about what does it mean to barter? Most people don't even know how to do that, right? I mean, have you tried to buy a car from a car dealership? My God, that's not bartering. That's just a mind fuck followed by a big payment, followed by a lot of buyer remorse is what it really is on the other end. That's not true bartering. True bartering is you sit there and argue about what it's worth until you get to a price that you can both deal with. And that our culture is not set up that way. And you watch this happen, you know, I watched this happen in several South American countries, and they're flat out arguing. I thought they were going to go to blows. And one of the guys that was with me, like, yeah, it's normal. Just let them go. Five more minutes, they'll be done. And then they're shaking hands, deal's done, they're on their way. Americans don't think that way. So it's a mindset change as much as it's going to be a situation change.
I think some of it's a mindset change for most Americans, but that culture. So like Matt was saying, we have a huge swap meet here in Phoenix too. And Phoenix has been known for having a lot of those flea markets where you could roll your, you know, two lawnmowers into the flea market and the small engine, you know, mechanic will fix one and take the other one that's broken in payment, that type of stuff. And that's pretty common, but getting back to the, you know, the warrior villages, I mean, if you're in a apartment complex, the problem with an apartment complex is that Americans are so introverted that they don't communicate. Imagine if it was a bunch of like-minded people that were in an apartment complex. That would be a very hard target. And as far as like we have a couple of these farmer markets that are very close to our house, and they're little artsy crafty things. So you have a few people with potatoes and tomatoes, and then you'll have Rebecca with her macrame and Steven with his coin collection and all this other stuff. So those types of things expand in hard times because people are going there. They're going, you know, like I love shooting film. So I have 35 millimeter cameras. Well, you know what? If I don't have any food, I don't have any money and there's no store and there's no shit fairy, I'm probably going to bring some 35 millimeter cameras down there. And I'm either going to try to market my skills by using them, or I'm just going to pair off that, you know, that camera for some other goods. And so that bartering that you're talking about and the multi-layer currency type of environment, that's going to evolve naturally. People have a lot of stuff, but that's when I think people are going to find out what stuff do you have. Because I have tools and I have knives and I have cameras. I have things that are relevant, things that can accomplish objectives. I don't have fucking knickknacks. You're not going to go down there with a, you know, with your bookends that are like Schnauzer bookends and your little LED plant light and your fucking bullshit. And you're going to starve to death and nobody's going to buy it. So you're going to really need to take stock of the things that you have that you invest in, and what you have is just junk. And so having a blown up economy is really going to, you know, people are going to figure that out pretty quickly. But as far as, you know, like what can you do now? Not everybody is going to go to a compound. And honestly, I mean, the guys on this phone, I'm just going to share. I'm going to put this out there, and then you guys tell me if maybe, you know, you agree or you don't agree. There's been several opportunities where we had an opportunity to buy 12 acres, 40 acres, 15 acres, 5 acres with like a 9-room, you know, building and outbuildings and stuff on it. And it was outside of my financial ability. But I thought, wow, you know, if I got with my brother-in-law and his wife, or, you know, my buddy and his wife, or so-and-so, and we had two or three or four couples, we could just go all in on this. All of us would be paying less money. We would have this awesome thing. We would have leveraged resources. We'd have, you know, scale. And every single conversation like that ended with, yeah, but I don't think any of us could live with each other for that long. You know, you were all in one house like Dallas, and you got the one kitchen and you got everybody's fucking shit. You know, we're not Asians. We're not Hispanics. We're not going to live in a multi family deal. But as a sociologist, I'm sure you've studied that, that, you know, the generally like the Catholic Hispanics and the Asians will do that. They'll come in, they'll group up, even if it's one apartment, and all of them, they're very hard workers. They'll all go out, they'll work, they'll start to amass money. They have low overhead. They'll start to start businesses. And then when they're ready, they'll pair out and leave the nest. But they have a very collective, you know, mindset, and they generally take care of their elders, and they, you know, they linger. We send people off to old folks' homes to die. We want to move out of our parents' house the day we turn 18. And so we have a lot of capability that we've just let go to the ether because we're so individualist. That's good in a lot of ways, but, you know, in the situation that we're going into now, I think that that communal mentality for survival has definitely been bred out of us.
It's actually more natural, though. One of the weirdest things I discovered when I was looking at this barbarian village, that you're correct right now, but Europeans could not believe that on this continent, especially when we started doing the 40 acres and a mule land giveaways and stuff back in the day, that our government basically isolated houses that were at least a mile from other houses. That's where your 40 acres were. Europeans that came over were like, whoa, what? Even the peasants were accustomed to for thousands of years working land but living in like a village style thing. And you can go back and read old magazine articles from like the 1860s, 1870s, and it was like a change. It was like a massive, like, forced evolutionary change. And you could also argue that that's where a portion at least of our problems as Americans came from. You know, it made us more isolated, it made family units way more isolated. People weren't really meant to live like that. You know, we had mountain men and stuff like that, but for most of the rest of the time, even on this continent, you know, out on the frontier, people lived in forts. This like, you wage slave on your own thing far away from everybody else is really only an invention from like 1870, 1880, depending on when your area was Indian free, excuse me, Native American free.
Yeah, it actually picked up the pace post-World War II. So going into World War II, that generated in the 1930s, people by and large lived in essentially small compounds. And the way that it would break down is when the patriarch of the family wrote out his will at whatever the family home was, he would normally divide up the land for when he passed on between, you know, his kids. And so they would end up with smaller and smaller parcels of land. That worked for the era. And then, you know, macro level with urbanization after World War II, you got, you know, all American GIs coming back home, led to the baby boom. Well, what it also did was it led to suburbia. Because this was not previously a thing. All right. Suburban stuff never existed. You had the cities, essentially. You had landed estates outside of it as part of the capitalist class. And then you had your rural areas outside of that. Well, you know, after World War II, we got sold on, you know, and this was largely a propaganda of things that were producing war material. And now they had to keep those people employed. They had to keep those factories open. So they start building all this other stuff. And that was where the idea of the American dream came from. Oh, the American dream, you'll have two cars and a house and a, you know, wife wearing a French maid outfit or whatever, like, leave it to be. This was all propaganda. This, all of it. So 100% of this was propaganda. They were selling the American public on this idea of buying a small parcel of land. You don't need all that. And you don't need to have 20 sons, right? You don't need to do any of that. So our birth rates dropped, right? Across the board in the United States, the birth rates dropped. It was called the baby boom because there were a lot of kids, but the aggregate level birth rate dropped, and it continued to drop after that because people didn't want to have more kids.
Right.
That two is enough. We don't need to have more than that.
Yeah.
Right.
And the change was also about stuff, right? Migrating the public away from, you know, land ownership, farming, agrarian, right, to you got to accumulate stuff. Start with the house. The house is most important, which before it was the land that was most important. And it was a massive, massive shift in the cultural narrative, right?
And when you look at the development of corporate agriculture, so, you know, ConAgra, for example, right? Conglomerate of agriculture, ConAgra. And in where we find ourselves today, Bill Gates and, you know, and all the usual suspects trying to mess with the food supply. Why is it that they have that power to do that? It's because everybody that previously had family farms, they divested all of that. A lot of them went on to go do whatever else. They're living in suburbia and they gave up on that idea. And now they've made it impossible. This is what I was saying early on in the show, was that it's made it impossible for younger millennials, late millennials and Gen Z, to ever even actually own anything. Like when they say, when you have Klaus Schwab, so on and so forth, saying you'll own nothing and love it, this is actually what he's talking about, is that you won't even have the ability to compete with them in terms of wealth creation. And they can just create through the notion of cultural hegemony, they can simply make you feel happy, right? No, you're right here. I mean, it's Brave New World. It's Aldous Huxley. But this is the doctrine that they follow. The pushback against this idea and you know, how you do that is literally by collectivizing, right? This idea of individuality, individualism, so on and so forth. Humans are pack hunters. Okay, we're pack hunters. We're meant to be pack hunters. Our physiology supports pack hunting. That's why if you look at a herd animal, their eyes are on the side of their head, right? And their nasal senses and their ears, normally they can turn their ears different directions to hear things, like a horse, for example. The nostrils are huge, right? So they're smelling things on a level that we never will. But we're predators. If you look at a predator in nature, they have different physiological traits. And so when you look at humans, we are very, very well adapted for violence, and in particular, violence as a group activity. And that's because we're pack hunters, right? And it doesn't take long to rekindle that at all. You know, I see it every class that I run. I see it, you know.
I'm trying not, I don't want to go down the road of group dynamics, right? Because that's a 2-hour discussion that drives everyone insane. But I agree with you, right? You devolve back to that tribal mentality in every instance like that when you have a group setting. I can think all the way back to things that I did in the field as a lieutenant. And when you get groups together, it just devolves into that almost every time. And it's organic. I don't think it's a functional setup. It's organic, and it just organically happens. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
I mean, not to say there's not going to be, you know, growing pains, especially the way that we are accustomed to living now, with, like, you know, my house and just my wife and kids and my shit. And, you know, no, that doesn't mean that we can't go back the way, though, because it's not that far in our past. It's really not. I mean, we're talking like 80 years in some cases, you know, maybe 100, 120. But it's not like that's completely evolved out of this. Now, it's not going to be fun. I mean, it would actually be awesome if I could just stay at my house and continue to have pizza delivered. But I do not personally feel like that's in the cards. So
I think that the what's in the cards is going to be, you know, hardship in a way and ambiguity in a way that most people have never seen. I mean, think about it. Most Americans, over 90%, have never seen ambiguity in a real form. They've seen some, you know, some strife, some, you know, limited resources, but nothing on the level of the third world or anything in some of the third world countries. We were talking about it earlier, right? Most people in this country don't know how to mend shit. They don't know how to fix shit, right? They call somebody to do that, or they take it somewhere to do that. Like, most people don't even know how to sew. And that's going to be a skill that's going to be 9 to 5. Like the home economics we used to teach back in the 80s and 90s in high school before the liberals took over and fucked everything up, used to be you would learn how to, you know, sew and cook. You would learn how to manage a checkbook. You would learn how the banking system works. But, you know, all of those things are lost. And, you know, in this community, people have gone back to canning. They've gone back to, you know, mending things and, you know, rudimentary home economics. But for a bulk of the population, clueless, blissfully unaware, blissfully.
And it gets worse by the year too.
Oh, they get it. I think Chris Rock said it the best. Keeping it real, real dumb. And that's what's happened. Right? They get dumber every year. They think about things in very simplistic terms. And think about the people that are, especially the people with no resources that are sitting in a city right now in an apartment. They shop every day for their meal. Imagine what's going to happen when the stores go sideways and there's no inventory. I mean, and that's not even the elderly fixed income population. I'm talking about just normal people. Like, there's a whole generation that doesn't want to drive. They want to use Uber and public transportation. They're fucked, right? And then you have a whole generation that is so wrapped up in, I've got to have 10 or 15 cars, right? They're fucked.
They're weeds.
And not to turn into the...
That's a good word.
They're it. Weeds. They're not going to make it.
Yeah. Not to turn into the old man ranting at the kids either. You know, get off my fucking lawn.
Go for it. Full set.
But, hey, look, in some cases, it's not their fault either, man. We've made this disposable society, which has only gotten worse. And you can see a shift. It's about 20 years ago when really, like, electronics and video games and shit totally took over kids' lives. Even before that, even in my era, you know, we learned how to fix cars and, you know, lawnmowers and all kinds of horse shit. I actually feel bad for the kids that have grown up in the last 20 years. It's kind of not their fault, man. Who the fuck was ever going to show them how to do things? Everything in their life has been disposable, and food, resources, all that stuff have only gotten cheaper and therefore easier to have. So, you know, I get it. But I do, on one hand, feel bad for them. You know, it's kind of not their fault.
My daughter was dating this kid, Ivan. She was early in college. She was like in her early 20s. And so Ivan's this Hispanic kid that grew up in Calexico. And my daughter calls me. She's dating this Mexican kid. And, Daddy, I need help. I'm like, what do you need help? She says, well, I got a flat. I'm like, you got a flat? She said, yeah, Ivan and I are stranded on the side of the road. I said, you and fucking Ivan? Does Ivan know how to change a tire? Put Ivan on the phone. Ivan, I want you to get the gun out of the console, and I want you to fucking shoot yourself. The kid literally did not know how to change a tire. And, you know, the Hispanic population in Arizona is a very masculine population. So I don't know what the fuck happened to Ivan, but it is, I mean, it drives to the point that Clay is making, is if you're a Mexican that grew up in Calexico and you do not know how to change a fucking tire, we're fucked as a society. We're literally fucked. It's going to thin out pretty quickly. And I mean, and there's no excuse for that, right? So I see a bunch of dead zones in the, you know, like when we work with the homeless, I think that the less you have, actually, the better off you're going to be when shit hits a fan. But then we're going to push out to Fountain Hills, and we're going to push out to North Scottsdale. And we have these multi-million dollar homes that are completely dependent upon the maid, Uber, and the power company. And those guys are generally not preppers. I'm sure there's a few that have compounded their aircraft or their domicile, but they're going to jump on a JSX and they're going to fly out of town. That's their plan. You know, like, well, you know, if stuff doesn't work out here, I'm just going to go to, you know, Peru or wherever, and I'm just going to stay there. So there's going to be a lot of people that are wealthy that are going to evacuate. And then there's going to be a lot of dead zones, but everywhere that they're shitty in the world, there's the bazaar. So people go to the swap meet and they get most of their stuff. And you're right. I mean, things kind of centralize, and then people go back to whatever their little areas are. And now all of these dead zones that are there, they're gonna get taken over. They're gonna turn into agriculture. They're gonna turn into somebody else's house until the owners get back or whatever. So I don't think that there's. I mean, it's gonna. My whole worry about cascading societal collapse is that first 6 months while the bodies are rotting, because I don't think anybody really understands what kind of problem we're gonna have when you have 30, 60, 80, 120,000 people that are dead for various reasons that we have no way to deal with. And they're going to come up with body burning, you know, real quick. I wrote that, the white paper I put out on our channels, it discusses that specifically is how to deal with dead pets and dead people. And a lot of that really is a humanitarian perspective, because if you come across somebody who is deceased, it's prudent to figure, you know, when did you find them? Do you know what their method of death was? How long have they been out there? You know, when you relocate them, can you locate them with any identifiable property? If they're there too long, then you're going to have to burn them, but at least you have a record of who they are, where you found them. And there's a lot of stuff that goes into that, but that's what needs to happen at that barbarian village level. Not, I mean, we're talking about 6 million people or however many in Maricopa County, and most people don't know anybody, and zero of them have any, you know, any kind of post-disaster management skill set. It's going to get pretty fucking ugly, you know, for the first year. I mean, it is not going to be a friendly place to live. And even people who are prepared, no matter how prepared you are and how well-trained you are, if your neighbor has a mosquito factory in his pool in the backyard, you're fucked. So you need to throw motor oil in there or, you know, whatever kind of shit you need to figure, you know, you need to think about that, mitigate all of these other environmental threats that are around your area. So that's something you could have at the top of the year list. You know, no matter where you live, if it's an apartment or if it's a house or a mobile home or whatever, is where are all these environmental threats that I do have control over that I can mitigate that are going to help increase my health, you know, baseline. And then start reading these white papers and these things that we put out on, you know, how to survive in this kind of austere environment. But that's the first thing. I don't honestly know how we're going to deal with a metropolitan size element that now has no water, no power, no sewage in the middle of the summertime. And that's going to be fucked. And none of us, I think, can even conceive how fucked that is.
Most people don't even know how to do field sanitation. Let's just call a spade, right? And I want to go back to something real quick, and then Matt, I'll hand it over to you and Clay. You know, I made my kids learn how to change a tire, learn how to change oil, learn how to deal with roadside emergencies, and they hated me for it. Absolutely hated me. I was the biggest dick in the world. And then they had a flat tire in the middle of the night, and I was a rock star because they knew exactly what to do. But it was that guy. And that's, it brings back the point that Matt, you were making earlier. Most parents don't want to do the parenting or the mentoring to grow. And let me just get this out of the way before everybody in the audience loses their fucking mind on me about parenting. I'm not saying everybody, I'm not saying you. I'm just saying there's a bulk of parents in this country that don't mentor their kids and want to be the bad guy. And sometimes you got to be the bad guy to mentor your kids and make them do things they don't want to do and they're uncomfortable at that moment. But later on, they'll thank you for it, right? The same things with my nephews. One of my nephews was determined he was going to do his own breaks. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to help, but I'll advise, right? And so he'd come in every few minutes and ask me a question. I'd walk out there with him and go, this. And, you know, it took him like 5 hours to do it. But when he was done, he knew exactly all the pitfalls of doing it, all the issues of doing it. And most importantly, he did it himself. And he wants to do more, right? So there's the other aspect of the mentoring, which is you're growing that talent and you're giving them the sense of accomplishment of doing that on their own, right? Most parents don't even push their kids in that way. It's like, oh, you want to stop playing baseball? I remember when I was playing, my parents are like, you quit, I'll beat the shit out of you on the field. And then I'm going to take you back to the car and beat the shit out of you again for embarrassing me on the field. And then when you get home, I'm going to beat the shit out of you again just so I can feel good, right? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
All right. I've talked too much already, so
I'm doing that. Just saying, daddy's got to do what a daddy's got to do. You know, sometimes that belt's got to get to go, or whatever else you can get your hands on. Man, I was a kid. I got my ass beat in anything. Like first thing, whatever they reach for, man. I had a 1x4 broke over my head one time. I deserve that one too. I earned it. I earned that one. That was But I mean, you know, with kids, you just gotta put them in a scenario. I mean, like, okay, look, fix this. I mean, that's what happened to me. Okay, All right, you got a flat tire on a tractor? Why'd you run that over? Okay, fix it. You know, like you get used to not just changing a tire, but running an impact wrench. How to set up an impact wrench, not to get your fucking hand broke by an impact wrench, and then how to turn around and patch that tire. Like, cause you ain't got money to buy a new tire. So, you got to do something. So, but nah, Trooper Man, that kid, your girl needs to pick better men, because I don't know if.
He's no longer in the picture. She had this other boyfriend that came over. My buddy Sean and I were roommates in our, you know, like no TV, no furniture, just like beer and guns leaning up in every corner of the house. And my daughter brought over this other kid, and his name was William. And William was a shitbag. And I could tell that William was a shitbag instantly. And we were sitting on the back patio drinking beer and doing all of our redneck single stuff. And here comes Amanda with this fucking William kid. And I'm like, Sean, I don't want this kid in my daughter's life. He said, we'll take care of it. So have you ever used those Barnes X bullets, those little rubber bullets that are primer fired? You can chamber them in your handgun. Those things will literally go through like both sides of an empty beer can. Mm. And so I thought, and you know, I'm not going to say you should, you know, that other fathers should do this today, but at the time I didn't give a shit and I'm 18 beers into it and why not? So we sat William down and said, hey, William, you ever heard the story of William Tell? You know, the dude with the, like the apple and shit, you want to play the William Tell game? And he's like, yeah, sure, I guess. So my buddy Sean like grabbed him, put a fucking beer can on. I said, I wouldn't move, motherfucker. And I dropped the magazine on my 45, and I already had one of those Barnes X bullets in the chamber, and I had hollow points in the mag. I'm like, here we go, buddy. And shot the beer can right off the top of his head. And he lost his shit. Of course, my daughter lost her shit too, because she liked William. I'm like, William, I'm going to give you a little piece of advice.
Yeah, I wonder why, Troop. What could possibly go wrong?
If you ever do anything to fuck with my daughter that I don't like, I'm going to fucking harm you. And, you know, and then he left, and I never saw him again. And my daughter didn't talk to me for a couple of weeks after that. But you know what? Fuck that
guy. Ladies and gentlemen, the parenting style edited here and presented here are those of Trooper and not those of the Lost Boys. I mean,
that was the time in my life I gave zero fucks about anything. So sometimes you have to intervene.
There are no words, know, man. There are no words.
Okay.
I don't have little girls, so.
All right, back on fucking track.
Yeah, let's get back on track.
No, Andrew, you bring up a very good point before committing crimes and shit about sanitation. This is actually one of the things that I brought up in Concrete Jungle. I'm like, hey, look, man, everything's, you know, survival and guns, all this other bullshit, except if the fucking water goes out, no city in the United States is viable after 3 days, because 3 days is about how long it takes for retards to get really thirsty and start drinking the sewer water and dying. And it doesn't take very long to overwhelm the sanitation, and then it's all fucked. I mean, it's all fucked after that. And I don't know that that's happened in the history of the world, because we've never really had, like, the population density that we have combined with the stupidity, and also combined with the lack of ability to deal with parasites. You know, it's not like there's going to be a fucking huge problem in Shanghai. They're used to drinking puddle water already. Atlanta, it's going to be a fucking problem.
We've had instances where weather events have caused the shitnados coming out of the toilet. And Steve, if you could find that post-disaster management thing from the Substack and post a link to it. Yeah. So my whole thing is make your house an island. So if, you know, in the moment that your water doesn't work, assume that your sewage is going to back up. So like shoving stuff down toilets and down, you know, closing off all your drains. Ideally, if you can close out the clean out, that water is going to come up depending on where you are from the sewage. And if it ain't going to come into your house, it's going to go into somebody else's. We've experienced that dozens of times in the United States with, you know, big floods and like everything's just overwhelmed. But we also had a disaster response. So we were able to pretty quickly deal with that. In fact, a buddy of mine worked for ServPro, which is a company you call, you know, when you have a flood and all that. And they have like an army of ServPro vehicles that they'll deploy to states and like after hurricanes and stuff like that. And they'll pay them essentially TDY to do thousands of houses at scale. But that's, you know, that's a functioning economy, a functioning business, a functioning fleet of people. They're getting paid functional money and they can get ahead of it pretty quickly. But yeah, if you have no sanitation, man, it's going to be bad. And those three rock stars and that, you know, that Bud Light in your refrigerator aren't going to last very long for hydration.
I think there's, so you bring up a good point, which I think is a good transition point. So if you had to, if you were going to mentor somebody, especially a younger generation, what would be the top three things you would mentor them on right now? And I asked each one of you to come up with top three, right? So let's start with you, Matt, and let's talk through that.
So first skill that they need to get mentored in is animal husbandry. Like in my mind, that's something that either you're born into it and you're just naturally good at it, the immersion with animals and stuff, or it's a constant uphill struggle. Like that's a skill that's one that's really lifelong. And you know, it's not an easy one to get into. So that's the first one. The second one, marksmanship, you know, competent marksmanship. And the ability to teach others marksmanship, you know, because I'm a great shooter, right? As probably everybody in here is, you know, Clay, teach people to shoot, you know. But if I'm not able to replicate myself on the battlefield, then I'm Jack Henson at that point. Like Jack Henson killed a bunch of Union officers, and that's, you know, great, cool. Did he win the war? No. So. You know, like his story is fascinating, but that's where it begins and ends. The third mentorship, I would say, just kind of me is land navigation. Land navigation's that's another skill. You either have it or you don't, and it's as much a self-confidence skill that you need. Like, hey, you know, I'm not gonna get lost out here because I know, you know, how to get from point A to point B, deviations along the way. And it's just basic competence. So when you see how many people these days, they can't get anywhere without their GPS on their phone. Like, they just can't. Like, that's natural. They don't know how to get anywhere. And, you know, something like a roadmap of your county, for example, and knowing where you are on there. Like, it doesn't have to be any fancy thing like protractors and math in this. But just, hey, where are you at on the map right now? Do you know? So, yeah, those three things.
Clay?
Those are excellent. I'm going to throw you four, actually. I'm going to say the first thing I would teach them is how to think and be competent in their own abilities. But that aside, actual real skills, it would be three that I know. First would be mechanical, basic mechanical stuff, because that in itself, aside from the benefit of knowing how to do basic mechanical shit, kind of does teach you how to think. It teaches you how to think in a different way than, you know, school and fucking nonsense does. Second, which I actually suck at, but I would teach it anyway, basic construction. I'm an awful carpenter, but I can build some shit that will stay together. It's not going to be pretty. I would not sell it to anyone, but it will hold up. And again, being able to like look at a pile of lumber and then turn it into some shit that's semi-functional is a different way of thought process, as well as just learning how to use tools. And then, just like Matt said, I'm going to go with that, how to fight after that in general. Guns, knives, sharp sticks, fucking fists. And it's like you said, if I can't replicate myself, what the fuck am I doing out here?
True.
The first thing I would say is water, and that's understanding enough about water to know if water can be made potable and what water can't. And then knowing what processes to go through to make that water potable, and then how to store it, transport it, and all that other stuff. So got a lot of videos on that. But the second part of that is, what do you do with the water? And that's hygiene. So if you're not taking care of yourself, you're not taking care of wounds, you're not taking care of your feet, you're not taking care of your skin, then it doesn't matter how much water you have, you're gonna get sick, you're gonna have problems. So water and then hygiene. And the third one, I was going to say, just being well-read and having, you know, understanding what ethics and chivalry are and having discipline to get through the difficult parts of the things you need to deal with. But as far as like a hard skill, for me, the third one would be temperature control, temperature regulation. So in the desert here, that's a completely different thing than it is in the summertime. But you have to understand, you know, basic things like we wear the schmeg, schmock, cravat, hat, umbrella, whatever. but you know, long sleeve shirts in the summertime, whatever, having the ability to limit the amount of exertion and water and energy that you need to keep going. And those three things would be the first three things on my list of things to teach.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would add a couple others to it too. Right. So one thing that we don't teach, and I've referenced it so many different times, it bears repeating. That's if you haven't read Lawrence Gonzalez's book, Deep Survival, you should read it, because he talks about accepting the situation you're in. Right. Most of us are taught that somebody's going to come rescue us, that we're going to have help nearby, we're going to have somebody that can come and step. That's not real. Right. In deep survival situations, most people don't even know how to deal with ambiguity, and they'll literally bitch themselves to death. And in other cases, people go, you know, hysterical and they die of shock. So there's the critical thinking around deep survival situations. Then there's the whole idea of dealing with ambiguity, which most people do not know how to deal with at all. They've never dealt with it. Right. In my business, in the security business, that's 90% of what I deal with is ambiguity, trying to figure out why the network's doing weird shit, why an application's doing weird shit. There's no rhyme or reason for it. And then we have to break it down into coherent pieces and then go and figure out what's actually happening. And if it's security related, or if it's just bad code, or if it's the environment, right? So that kind of ambiguity in the real world, most people don't know how to deal with. Like, you're stuck on the side of the road. There's no cars around you. There's no noise around you. There's no buildings around you. You're in the middle of nowhere. What do you do? That kind of ambiguity is what, you know, the younger generation needs to deal with. And then the last piece is just basic field hygiene. Like, what do you need to do to stay somewhat clean and to be able to operate without getting a cut on your finger and dying of an infection, right? Trip, you talk about water, and water is vitally important here, and it's going to be vitally important everywhere. But most people don't even know how to purify water, let alone how to think about and making that a part of their battle rhythm, right? In the military, we talk about battle rhythm. We talk about cadence. We talk about pre-planning. We talk about post-planning. We talk about after-action reviews. Most people have no idea what an after-action review is, right? And you make fun of it in the military. But let me tell you, when you're in a combat situation, you're doing an after-action review of a patrol that went sideways, you learn more about what you didn't do and what you weren't planning for to throw into the next planning cycle. Most people don't know how to plan, period. Full stop. Do not know how to plan. So if I can mentor kids on just how to plan for something and to, you know, build some critical thinking skills, that to me is a win. And, you know, we could go on and on, but all of you guys have experience with different forms and different layers of operations. Right.
But if we start doing MDMP, I quit though. Like, I don't even want to survive anymore. Like, I quit.
Yeah. I was staying away from it, bro, because that's the bane of my existence too. Right. So, and there's no PowerPoint badges here.
There's no PowerPoint in the apocalypse. I love it. I'm making a t-shirt. We're done.
Yeah. So, but it's real life skills. Right. And the reason why we're bringing this up for the audience is right now is the time to start mentoring the younger generations on just basic survival and life skills. Not here's how it should be. This is what happens when you don't have water. This is how you go source water. Most people don't even know how to source water, right? It's not a fucking stick walking around, you know, trying to find a water supply. It doesn't work that way. But here's another one. If the electrical system goes down and critical infrastructure goes down, most people don't know how to get gas from a tank out of the ground. Most people don't know how to siphon gas. Most people don't even know how to check and see if gas is good and how much water is in gas, right? Or if gas has been in the ground too long and is breaking down. That's just one example of many examples that
when my wife got that diesel truck, I thought, this is the only procurement tool that I need to get more diesel. It's in a bucket, right? So, but on that, you know, the shit fairy thing, I do these classes on, you know, I hate this term bug out bag. It pisses me off every time I hear it.
Bug out bag.
Yeah. My bag that I carry, it fits inside of a 5 gallon bucket. It like literally fits inside of a 5 gallon bucket with 3 liters of water, with a Sawyer, with, you know, chemical, you know, chlorination tablets, with a poncho and a Schmeg and an extra pair of socks and all, you know, random other shit that I need, but it literally fits inside of a 5 gallon bucket. And so there's videos on it. Don't want to get into it, but you should have a basic kit of stuff that weighs, I think mine's down to like 11 to 15, depending if I have the bladder full. But a basic kit of stuff that fits inside of a 5 gallon bucket for you, and then one for every member of your family. So you don't have dad the tank with 50 pounds of stuff, and then you take dad out and, you know, little Timmy's not going to pick up the 70 pound Alice pack. So everybody should have their individual bag of stuff, but it doesn't need to be a big bag of stuff. And you know, so before you go into buying all the stuff from the shit fairy, just if it doesn't fit in a 5 gallon bucket, I have too much stuff, you know, from just a baseline.
Yeah. Well, what's the intent, right? Because everybody thinks the intent of a bug out bag is you're going to throw a pack on your back with a bunch of ammo and a bunch of shit. We talked about this earlier too, which by the way, all that shit's heavy. Just throwing that out there. Ammo's heavy, water's heavy, food's heavy, all your other shit's heavy. And when you add heavy shit to heavy shit, you move slow, you burn through a lot of calories, you burn through a lot of water, you don't go very far. The whole intent of the bug out bag, which Troop hates, is to get you back to what they call, you know, basically a safe area, right? And most people don't plan longer than 24 hours. And, you know, you can use the 2-day rule, the 3-day rule, or the 24-hour rule. It's up to you, which, you know, depending on your travel and your movement habits, right? So the whole point of it is to get you back to an area where you have resources. It's not to sustain you.
My Jeep is my bug out bag. It has all my heavy stuff in it. The bag that I always carry with me, the thing that really confuses me about this term is I also heard this term get home bag. I'm like, so you got a bag for when you're not at home, and then you got a bag for when you are at home? Like, shouldn't that be the same bag? You know, like literally, you don't know where you're going to be when you need the shit in that bag. So why, you know, what? I don't get that, right? But there's a difference between evacuating, being displaced, and, you know, having to, you know, flee the area, right? If you have a tornado coming in, you got a warning that there's a tornado coming in, you can grab your stuff, you can leave town, you know you're going to come back in a few weeks, hopefully your house is there, versus Palo Verde nuclear plant blew up, there's a green cloud coming my way, I ain't ever coming back here. So, you know, you're leaving. But there's a difference between, you know, being displaced and you know, being evacuated. And so your bag of stuff is designed to do all those things that I said. Make sure that you know, if you can identify water that can be made potable, you should be able to have the capability to make it potable. You should have the ability to, you know, provide self-care. You should have the ability to assure that you can maintain temperature control. And so all the other stuff, the heavy stuff, is in my Jeep, and it's temperature specific, season specific. I have a billy can, think of a coffee can, like a number 10 can, that's in my Jeep specifically for if I break down up in the cold country. And that little billy can is there so I can build a fire outside my Jeep. I can put hot rocks in that billy can. I can bring that billy can inside my Jeep. And now I'm having radiant, non-toxic heat that's not going to burn my Jeep down or suffocate me, that takes up zero room. And there's other stuff in that can that I can use. Now, I'm not going to carry something like that in my backpack, but that's something I'm going to utilize, you know, in the environment that I'm in that vehicle. So the whole idea of, you know, what can you put in your car and what you can't. The other part of having a bag that is all, you know, you should bring it with you when you leave the house, you should bring it in with you when you come home, is the sensitive things like the hydrocolloid bandages or any food you may have in there or that other stuff. That stuff needs to be where your human body feels comfortable. And stuff that can be in extreme hot or extreme cold, you know, maybe you can leave that stuff in your vehicle. But, you know, your basic bag, though, you know, water treatment, temperature regulation, self-care. And then if you want to add other stuff to it, then, you know, that's great. But all that stuff could fit in a 5 gallon bucket.
Yeah, I agree. So last topic I want to talk to you. Let me check my notes here. before I get too far down the road here. Call to action. That was the one we didn't get to. So call to action. So specific things that the audience should be doing right now in their community, not related to elections, but other ways to get involved in their community and places to plug in.
You go to church? You have a, well, I'm saying, I mean, there's a,
I'm laughing at the blank stares.
Yeah. I do my church every Saturday at the homeless camp. Where do you go to know people? And if you're, everybody you know is on Facebook, then you need to get out in the world and meet some people. I don't understand where this is lost. I hated being single, and I won't tell you single Brent jokes, but I got out in the world and I just started talking to people, and my friend's like, dude, you should get on Face Finder, where you go and you look at chicks and you add one to the shopping cart and then you do a date with her or whatever. Well, I don't need that fucking shit. Go to the grocery store with a dirty t-shirt, put some Cheetos in the cart with a six pack of beer, put a sad face on, you'd be banging a MILF within 5 hours. You know, you got to get out in the world and you need to meet people and you need to get shit done. And people are afraid to do that. They're literally afraid to leave their house. So if you can't leave your house, how are you going to meet anybody that you're going to be able to synergize with
in order
to have a common cause?
Nothing. Right?
So whether it's church or whether it's a user group, or, you know, if you're into cameras, join a camera group. And if you're into golf, maybe go golfing more often and maybe meet some golfing people or whatever, but get out and meet some people. I mean, that's be the first step. If you're not at that step yet, your chances of survival are pretty low.
I want to know how you haven't written a book about the other part yet.
I was going to say.
Okay. All right. Talk about surviving and not Trooper's dick surviving. Okay. No, that's great. No, I agree with that. You know, doing that is one of the most important things we can do right now. So if you're not going to do that, the second thing is go fucking get some strong. All right, they're called biceps. You get them at the gym. People wrapped up in this idea that, you know, you got to be a fucking Calvin Klein model and all this other bullshit. No, man, that's not true. If your shit sucks for like strength or endurance or any of that other bullshit, which all of which is important, and start with fucking 5 minutes a day. Do some goddamn yoga stretches. Pick up like a fucking little kettlebell and do like one little gay exercise. It's still gonna help. All right, it's so much more about consistency than it is about, you know, some 2 hour long program that was made by Navy SEALs or some other bullshit. Just do some little stuff, man. It'll help.
All of that, and meet your local meat farmer. Like, dude's raising cows. Go meet him. Go meet him. Go Trooper. Meet him. Go talk to him.
Trooper is the local very meat farmer.
Yeah. Like, go. Go find that guy. Like, so had some cows delivered the other day, heifer and calf combos that were delivered and, you know, starting a new herd. Well, you know, talking to the guy that literally breeds cows, right? Talking to him, and we were making small talk and like got everything done, to, you know, checking the cows out and everything. And we're talking about it. And we're talking about other animals other than beef, like how popular goats are right now. You know, when I was growing up, like goats were kind of a novelty. People didn't really like, we had them, but they weren't really for any, you know, they weren't for like any other purpose other than killing kudzu off. You know, you like launch them on a kudzu and they'll just pick it all clean. It's the only way you keep it in check. Well, you know, now you've got all these people that have come here. I mean, like, you know, it's all these new people. You've got the Latin community. We've got people from Africa. Like, they all eat a lot of goat, you know? So that's a big deal, you know? And hogs, like hogs here, that's, you know, we're always going to have that. There's always going to be people raising hogs. But if you link up with your local meat farmer, because people are not trusting their food sources. All right. I don't trust anything that comes from a normal grocery store, or like, especially not Walmart. You go in there, like, dude, you don't know what they're doing to the meat. Like, all right, so it says it's beef on it, but how do you really know? I mean, this is like, I don't know, I don't want to put tinfoil hat on, but I don't trust our food supply at all. I mean, anything. And so, local meat farms, whoever's making local produce, something around it. You can find these people in your community. Everywhere I travel. I mean, I go, like, I was just out in Montana running a class, be in Missouri. I'll be down in Texas during the summer, about to go out to Wyoming. In every place that I go, I look for this. And I may only be there for 3 or 4 days, but I still notice little things about the communities like that. And I think in my head, like, okay, if the world went sideways and I was, trapped in Du Bois, Wyoming, for example, which is close to where the class is going to be, who would I need to talk to get resources? Like how am I going to eat? There's only one way into this town and one way out. So how am I going to be an asset to that community, and who would I need to talk to? So that's really what you need to be doing. Like link up with local farmers. 'Cause here's the other thing too. Talking about a conflict model, since we can always distill it down to like some military reference thing, 'cause people like that. But in Afghanistan, for example, and my first tour in Iraq and Kirkuk was like this, but it was really true in Afghanistan. A lot of times the people in the rural areas didn't really care about Americans one way or the other, but they got real pissed off when we fucked with their crops or like fucked with their livestock. That's their livelihood, man. Like they can't just go to a store and get more. Like if you screw around with their food supply, they may not eat through the winter. Like that is their insurance. So when you think about it, that was what in Afghanistan, the Taliban exploited that, because they like the night letters. If you ever recovered one of these night letters, Clay, you probably did. You've seen them. I saw them, and you got your Terp there and he's translating it. Everything in there was written to appeal to common culture. Like, hey, the tourists, what they call us, they don't appreciate our culture. They're here. This is the things that they're doing. You can support us, or, you can be on the other side of that. You can be on the wrong side of history. It was what a lot of the times that was what the language was distilled down to. So here's the benefit of you and your community linking up with the local farmers, people that have been there for multiple generations. You get on their good side by doing business with them. That's the fastest way to make friends, is do business with them, right? And so then when that community is under threat from whatever that may be, the world's gone sideways, whatever it is, you can offer them a level of protection, or they may seek it from you. And that's building frith. That's building ties with local populace, right? That's what you should be striving to do. And that doesn't just happen overnight. It doesn't just immediately happen. Trust built over time. And how do you do that? By doing business with them now. Know where your food's coming from, and there's all the second and third order effects that are good that goes along with that,
and not your butcher shop, which I think that's a good call out, right? Because there's a difference between a butcher and a butcher shop and somebody who's growing beef, right? Because they can tell you what vaccination level and what set of hormones their cattle have been given, right? Because the FDA is mandating mRNA vaccines for cattle and livestock right now. So there's a bunch of let's just say cattle and ranchers that are saying, well, I'm never putting that in my cattle, right? It'd be good to identify who those are. The other one is to go identify who the dairy farmers are and figure out which dairy farmers are trustworthy and which ones will actually trade and barter with you. Because you might be surprised, right? And I'm not talking about, the dairy farmer from the sit rep where he's dipping the dead chickens in the pasteurized milk. No, I'm talking about a real dairy farmer that's really checked in with the culture. And one of the places to find this, I know this is going to be an oxymoron, but it's true, is the farmer's market. When you go to a farmer's market, this is where you meet all, and I'm not talking about the yarn heads with their little shit dog and their fucking Starbucks and all the other bullshit and their Birkenstocks and their fucking hair and their tattoos and their fucking shrapnel in their face. I'm not talking about those people. Yeah, fuck you. Anyway, I'm talking about the people that are actually selling and growing things at the farmer's market. They're usually dialed into a bigger community and can tell you where, you know, who's growing cattle, who's growing the best fruit, who's growing selling real healthy soaps, real healthy hygiene stuff. I mean, you may take that for granted, but that most people don't know how to do hygiene without soap. And that is a skill that is lost. And trust me, you're not going to have enough fucking dial for the entire boog. Just get that. Just like TP. You're not going to have enough toilet paper for the entire zombie apocalypse. So you better figure out a way for field hygiene without all of those luxuries, because they're going to be gone. And anybody here that's been in the field long enough will tell you that shit runs out in the field too. And you have to be very fucking creative about what you do to stay clean.
For bad and hot water. So
believe it or not, a lot of these farmers markets, a lot of these people are they produce things at home, they know how to produce, and they're willing to share with you how to do these things. You just have to strike up a conversation with them. You know, and my girlfriend's amazing at it. She's never met a stranger. She knows all the beef producers. She knows all the people that own chickens. She knows all the people that know how to source and to come up with antibiotics for chickens. She knows, she's got that fucking dialed in at the farmer's market. I'm watching her go around, you know, talking to all these people. And I'm thinking to myself, here I am talking about making human connections, and I'm watching her do it, and I'm standing here with my thumb in my ass. Okay, I'm a great role model. But the point is that find your niche. And other places to go look for people, right? If you're a veteran, you can go to any of the Veterans of Foreign Wars. You can go to American Legion. You can go to and check into any of the veterans groups around there. You can find them. They're not hard to find. You can find veteran groups of your church. You can find, you know, ham radio people in every community. I will warn you that if you're like me, and they start talking about specific antennas and model numbers, you're going to be overwhelmed quickly with the technical jargon. But if you bear
jump in there, Steve.
If you bear with it, you're going to get a lot out of it. Go ahead, Drew.
So my niece, my first favorite niece, I have my first, second, all the way down to like my eighth favorite niece. And it's just basically in the order that they were born. So like I told my third favorite niece, what happens if you kill my first favorite niece? She said, I'm still your third favorite niece, which is true. My first favorite niece does her own goats and she raises all kinds of stuff. She's always been around animals, and she's here in Phoenix. We're going to do a video, and I invited Krista over there, Steve, to do. She's going to harvest some of her quail. These aren't the quails that we see in Arizona, but these other like little speckled quail. And she's already got she separated out breeding pairs, and like you take the biggest ones and this animal husbandry thing that Matt's talking about, and then you call out the rest of them. But she trades her goat milk. They drink goat milk. My daughter, who is allegedly lactose intolerant, which she wasn't the whole life that she lived under my roof, but somehow she's lactose intolerant now. She drinks the goat milk. She says, a lot of lactose intolerant people drink it. It doesn't have any of that bullshit in it. And then weird stuff like goose eggs. They're huge goose eggs, right? Or duck egg. I think it's goose eggs. But they're like really big eggs. So these are things that are happening in a backyard the size of mine, where people are having these animals. And a lot of people may not know this, but if you live in pretty much any city, you're allowed to have hens in your backyard. You can't have a rooster, but you can have hens in your backyard. And so that's like the first thing that you can do to not only get the eggs and maybe the poultry, but to keep the bug population under control as well. But the question is, what Steve was saying, is you go to meet all these people at the farmer's market, is what do they need? And I know my niece, for example, she had a problem with her bathroom, like the fan didn't work, and there was some other plumbing and electrical issues. Well, you know, if you're handy with tools and you go to the farmer's market and they got all kinds of good stuff and they have a little bit of work, you bring your tools over there, you fix their problem, they fix yours. And this is that, you know, that alternative economy that Clay is talking about. it's very simple to get involved with that if you're going to the places where, you know, people are going to communicate, and the most secure communications that you can have. And Matt, I listened to your podcast. You're on something I would listen to today, and you were talking about the, Signal versus Telegram versus whatever. But the most secure form of communication is face to face, and what we call campfire discussions, where all the electronics are somewhere where, you know, you're not, and everybody's communicating. So there's just so much that you can do when you start participating in these little enclaves of society, and then they become consistent. You know, they're always Wednesday at noon, or they're always Saturday between 9 and 1, or whatever. So having that consistency is very valuable, and that's also what's going to recover our society. Now, on our side, Steve and I are going to do some synergizing and networking up in Yavapai County, and we are going to establish comms from Yavapai to here to Tucson and then up to Flagstaff. But then also this thing I was talking to Janet about is this, what I'm calling the Pony Express, for lack of a better term, but we're going to do an exercise. So one of the things that Steve and I are going to do is we're just going to go up I-17, which is a major freeway that runs south-north through Arizona. It cuts it in half. And my thing is, I get freaked out if I don't know what choke points are between off-ramp and off-ramp. So if I pull off on this off-ramp, am I going to be in trouble? If I go through this mountain pass, how many miles is it before, you know, I can get off the freeway? Is this a good place that I can pull over and hide something, stash a cache, or maybe have an alternative route to get off the freeway and then continue on my journey on a different route? So you have to sometimes just drive that map, because Google isn't going to show you everything that you need. And sometimes you need to travel those roads to see if they're actually passable. So Steve and I are going to do that to set up our maps. But what's going to come from that is this participation that we're going to take a package, like a box of brownies, and we're going to have it go from Tucson to Casa Grande. And then from Casa Grande, somebody's going to take those donuts or whatever to Tonopah, and then to Phoenix, and then to North Phoenix, and then maybe to Steve's house, and then up to Humboldt, and then to, you know, into Prescott, and then whatever. So we're going to see how far we can get that, like, cannonball run, Smokey and the Bandit type of Pony Express thing, get it operational. Because then you have people that are out in the field, they're communicating, they're using their own organic technology to synchronize, you're finding rendezvous points, and this could be mail, it could be resources, it could be people. And what got me thinking about that was, we have a few people that live, you know, down in South Phoenix. Well, that's probably not the best place to be, you know, when shit hits a fan, and you may not have to migrate very far, but you may have to migrate maybe 20 miles away from where you're at. So how do you do that? What are the alternative networks? What are the alternative avenues? Who do you know in the area who can get you and go, you know, I can't bring you too far, but I can bring you 2 miles up the road or whatever. So,
and we're going to do all of that.
We're doing all, yeah, we're already we're working all of on that. It.
And we're going to make maps. We're going to make strip maps. We're going to write all this shit down. Then we're going to leave all of our shit, steal an airplane, and get the fuck out of Dodge.
If there's an airplane available, that'd be great. Yeah. But, you know, if not, we're going to have to figure out how to navigate our conflict environment.
Sorry, that was low.
But you know, the point of that is we're active participants in that. And even, I know you're a big fan of Meshtastic Networking, Matt, you know, and it's like, you know, thing accolades. So I'm not too concerned with the security of it or with the triangulation concern, but we're going to talk to people that have that well deployed. And I want to better understand. It sounds to me like this is an integrated thing that runs on like one frequency and it does certain stuff or whatever. So if that's something that can be added to the tool belt that people can use, that's great. But my focus is like APRS, figuring out the NVIS frequencies and times for where we want to communicate within the state, and then what nets that we're going to set up on the HF side, you know, like from my house to your house. So those dates, those times, those communities and organizations, and then you keep going closer to local, down from that. And that's something that everybody can do just by talking to your neighbors. And again, like Steve and I went down and saw some friends of ours on the channel, and they live in a retirement community. And I said, you know what, if you're on 1 milligram of trooper oxide, and he's on 1 milligram of trooper oxide, and this guy dies and those pills are $8,000 a bottle, then you guys need to set up a pill library So go down to your rec center in your community hall. And if you're willing to share what kind of medications you're on, then, you know, if Bob dies, now Bob's wife has something that she could use to help all the other families, something marketable. And that's just a basic thing that you can do, even if you don't feel that you have a whole lot of capability. You do have a lot more capability than you think you do.
Agree. Wholeheartedly agree. All right. We're coming up on hour and a half. Let's do closing comments. Let's start with you, Clay.
So we're no, just kidding.
What are we talking about, man?
Oh my God.
I'm sorry, dude. Wasn't paying attention, man.
No. Hey, great discussion. I think everybody's overwhelming here is, got to find some friends first and then we can move on from there.
Matt.
Yeah. Building a community. I mean, get involved with the community you already have. One thing dovetail with Trooper's kind of diving into Kamo, just kind of a parting shot and something to think about. Here in North Carolina, CB radio is literally all in Spanish. All right. 100%. All of it. All 40 channels, by the way. I've been talking about that community as its own parallel society. That's what they're utilizing. It's not complicated. It's not fancy. It just works. Guess what? So last week I was in Montana teaching RTO course, a radio telephone operator course. And they're in the portion of class where they do some neat things with CB. Not talking on them, but you're doing some neat stuff with them. Well, all 40 channels yet again in Spanish. And I literally had just said, I really doubt like that's going to happen up here because we're almost at the Canadian border. Like, we're in Kalispell, Montana. Like that ain't going to happen. Lo and behold, like literally all 40 channels were full of Spanish language. And guess what? Just about a month prior, a whole busload of people had got dumped off from the border at Kalispell, right? Just dumped off in the middle of the night. They had already set up their communications network. I mean, it was that fast. They knew exactly what they were going to do. CB equipment is proliferated literally everywhere, and it's common. So anyway, things to think about.
Troop?
You made a good point. I've made this point as well, and that's don't lose your faith. Don't lose your purpose. Don't lose your direction. We have been going through these types of, sinusoidal epics in history for as long as we've had recorded history, where some shitty thing happened, everybody suffered, they fixed it. And then, and the crazy thing is we are looking at World War II, and that was only 75, 80 years ago. And we thought this will never happen again. And think of all the stuff that transpired between then and now. And depending on what country you're in, there's been a whole bunch of little things interleaved in there. We thought these are great, horrible things. And what's happened between then and now, we're going to go into some headwinds. So don't go into a Pollyanna mindset that somehow everything's going to be okay. Or maybe everybody on this call is bullshitting you. But when things get progressively more difficult and painful to the point where you no longer have confirmation bias and it's like, oh wow, the pot's boiling now, don't lose your faith and don't lose your humanity either, because the easiest thing to do is to fall back on the hatred, fall back on the anger, fall back on the angst, and fall back on all the things that are not healthy. They're not productive. They're not going to contribute to society. So be a leader, be a brother, be a sister, be a mentor, be a participant. And don't lose faith. There's a reason why we live in this country, and it requires all of us. You don't have to be a Colonel Murray or a Clay or a Matt to be able to add value in your community, in your home. And don't think that you need to be. Don't think that you need to be Rambo or that you need to be Bill Gates or whatever. You just need to be you, and you need to be focused on first taking care of yourself and then taking care of your family. And if that's all you can do because you're elderly or disabled or have somebody disabled at home or whatever, then if you've got that part taken care of, if you got those two or three members of society taken care of, then you're lessening the load on the rest of society that's trying to figure out everything else. So don't lose faith, don't lose hope, and don't lose your self-worth, no matter how difficult things get. And if you do that, we're going to get through this. We always get through whatever's going on in the world.
Thanks, gents. I'll just say this. Make visceral connections, make human connections, put down the tech, walk away from your computer, and go out and meet people. Now's the time to do that. You may not get another chance. And while you're at it, start being a part of something. Start somewhere. Pick one activity every week to do, to be prepared, whether that's go set up radios, whether that's set up your gear, whether that's use your gear, whether that's getting your weapons in order. Do something every single week. Pick one major activity and do it every week. This week, the thing I did this week is I took troop solar chargers and put it into an ammo can and made a cleaner finish so it fits better in the back of my truck. But he built the bag with the solar charger. I put it in an ammo can this week, and as well as replaced a couple of barrels on my ARs, and I did some gear work. And, you know, you'd be surprised. And talking about shooting, Matt was talking about shooting. Troop helped me with pistol skills because, you know, I hadn't been on the range with a pistol in a long time and developed some bad habits. And I was out shooting and he squared me away. Don't be bashful about taking feedback from people around you because I'm surrounded by experts in their domains. And, you know, I have a choice. Every time I go out, I can listen or I can blow it off. I just assume I know what I'm doing. And you'd be surprised. Your skills atrophy, muscle memory is going to be the thing that carries you through when things go sideways. So use that time wisely. And, you know, don't be bashful about asking questions, especially, and you can throw questions in the Telegram. You can throw questions into the comments, and we'll do our best to field them. We all talk during the week prior to this and after this. So all of us are more than willing to answer questions. Right? So take the time that you have now, use it wisely, because when it all kicks off, it's going to be 99% sheer terror, 1% boredom. And right now it's 99% boredom, 1% sheer terror. You might as well use that 99% of your time to the best of your ability. And don't be scared. Lose the fucking fear. There's not going to do you any good to be scared. Everybody's going to be scared. Think clearly, accept the situation you're in, move forward. That's all you can do. And we'll be back next week. Gents, thanks for the, sticking out for the new format. Thanks for the ambiguity in the topics today. Appreciate it. And we'll be back next week. I'll be back Monday. I'll be traveling next week, so I might have some technical issues. And we'll be back next Wednesday. God bless everyone. One team, one fight.
Go on.